coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. This is issue 2, I believe 54, Cole? 54, is that about right?
254 sounds good. We'll call it 254.
Let's not call it anything else. We don't want another lost episode situation on our hands. Tonight's a very special episode for Cole and I for a lot of different reasons.
255.
All right, I'll take 255. 255 it is.
Yeah, I think the numbering got a little off on the...
damn it.
On the files, but yeah, it is in fact 255.
So we're in the middle of a story arc, Cole aptly named Turning Japanese, about the Japanese influence on our American comics, which so far we've kind of, you know, we talked about the feudal ages of comic books, or time period in American comics.
The feudal Japan, not futile Japan.
Right. Feudal Japan. Yeah. And then
Japanese resistance was futile.
last time we talked about ninjas.
That's right.
I feel like we did ninjas justice, and after the show, of course, I kept coming up with more and more things that we needed to talk about that we didn't. Elektra being a big one. I think we were. But trust me, we're going back to the Frank Miller well tonight at some point, so don't worry. tonight we dip our toes into waters that I think we're a little horrified that are full of alligators and various other predatory beasts.
Alligators and piranha and electric eels and any number of things that they've all. Reach an accord to only attack us.
But the problem with that is I'm pretty sure that if we could speak the language, some kind of reptilian base language, that those gators and all of those animals, or the Piscine death machines, would welcome us with open arms. We just can't get past the what would be the language gap, and the whole point of this issue is that we're trying to do that. We're trying to understand something that in our combined, you know, what we figured it at one point, it's like 65 odd years of comic book reading and studying and trying to understand has just slipped through my grasp like so much sand on a beach.
And the thing about it is, if you look at it from the standpoint of body of work,
yes,
tonight's topic encompasses tens of thousands of titles and books and, you know, literally just some ungodly number of millions of pages of printed material.
And by all accounts, 400 years. 400 years of actual human history. So what we're going to attempt to figure out tonight, as the show subtitled Two White Dudes, Two Middle-Aged White Dudes Doing Our Best to Get It Right, is manga. Manga
that's right.
Elusive beast for our generation. I apologize in advance for what's for the next 50 minutes or so.
Yeah,
ladies and gentlemen,
we are going to try our dead level best to do justice to something that is just not in our wheelhouse. But that was part of why this became an arc, was to challenge us, to get us to approach a subject that is patently unfamiliar.
Yeah. Oh. Well. Okay. So here's the thing. Absolutely familiar, right? Like you and I both.
Well, from the standpoint of awareness, perhaps.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, if you asked us what manga was, we could answer that question, right? They're, from our perspective, they're Japanese comic books. They've been around forever. Regardless of what you know, for a long time before my paradigm shifted, taking up space in my Barnes and Noble and Half Price Books and comic book shops for books that I would want. I personally have found, I'm sorry, but I'm gonna be honest. I personally have found very little use for the medium. I will say this. Like I said, that was prior to my sort of, I'm going to call it my paradigm shift. Yep. Post paradigm shift, I have found
PPS is what you call it.
PPS.
PPS. Yeah.
The PPS, right? I have found plenty of manga that I enjoy. So Berserk is a title that I've enjoyed in the past.
Oh wow! There's irony, because in my garage.
There are dead.
In the words children. Of, well, there's that, but no, just the souls.
But that's not because you killed them. They just went into your garage because it's full of toys, and then a rack fell on them.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Every time, that's why I don't clean up out there. It's heartbreaking to discover. But out there in the words of Ray Wise in Twin Peaks. Wrapped in plastic are four volumes of Berserk, the loan of which I have had for so long that I don't know I could ever find their owner.
I mean,
and to my personal shame, I have never cracked the covers.
So here's my experience, right, with this. And again, this is all a lot of this because the problem is, right, at 40 years old, researching this for a week, I wasn't able to even get to the surface to begin to scratch the history. I can give you, and there are a lot of great resources for this. There's a website called Wide Walls that had a great short history of manga that was pretty interesting. You know, all kinds of people have written thesis papers for schools that I've found, that I've read, trying to understand what I was getting myself into here. Because when I started reading comics, when I was but a young lad, we had, I think we've talked about this in the past on the show, things like Astro Boy, absolutely. Speed Racer, absolutely. You know, things like that existed, and we knew what they were, and they were niche and they were cool,
and we knew that they were Japanese in origin. There was something about that was already in our vernacular without us really knowing.
Right. Well, I mean, you just knew. Like, you know, it was right there. You knew it was different, you know. So that existed. But as time went on, and as you started getting more and more, you know, infused with globalist, not to get too Alex Jonesy, but as the world became more globalist, shout out Austin, Texas, and more of this came stateside, and the internet became a thing that existed, and there became a marketplace here. The conventions that I would go to and the stores that I would have, the ratio was starting to ratchet up.
Exactly.
Of these digest-sized books.
Well, they stopped being just a novelty.
Right. And, you know, you'd go to conventions and there would be dealers with just shelves and shelves and shelves of these things. And I'm like, what is this? And I would, you know, and Grandpa Farmer at whatever age was, you know, just unenthused with the concept of what this was. Little did I know that it was going to encapsulate, it was going to become a $400 million industry.
Good Lord, yes.
You know, worldwide. And 25, I think the last report I read was like 25% of all printed material in Japan was manga, which is
not at all surprising because, you know, we like to imagine that we are, or, you know, we like to point out that we're kind of an escapist culture here. But in many ways, the Japanese culture is equally, if not more so. And just the sheer volume of work out there.
So I, you know, I did some research here and tried to figure some stuff out, and I'm just kind of leaning very, very heavily on some of the research that I've done. And a lot of it makes absolute sense, right? We kind of talked about the birth of manga and the birth of Japanese influence on American comics back in the first issue a couple weeks ago when we were talking about me traveling to the Dayton Art Institute and seeing the original manga that was there and those, you know, in the pictures and the art and just how blown away. That was my what are we calling it? Paradigm shift? Is that?
Yeah, I guess that's and that's what's really fascinating is the research that you had brought to bear. A lot of it, or some of it, has talks about that very fact that there are these ancient origins to what would become manga. You can see the beginnings of it.
Yeah, yeah, and
the idea of an illustrated tale.
One of the first kind of, I guess, you know, there were illustrated. Obviously, there have been illustrated tales since, you know, recorded history and since somebody put a handprint on a cave wall. Yeah, and lit a fire and told a story with it, right? But this is kind of the first, I guess, serialized. You know, there were scrolls made with serialized stories with reoccurring characters in a plot line. And this is the first of that kind, ultimately, that we know of, that was said, okay, this character went on adventures or,
yes,
you know, and it's been recorded in such a fashion. But really what we're talking about here, the birth of modern manga happened at the most obvious time that you could ever imagine. And also probably one of the worst times that it could possibly have happened, which is, by all reports, started with the U.S. occupation of Japan after World War II. God damn it, we're awful people. We're an awful people. So what happened was, there was all this manga that existed. There was all this Japanese art and storytelling, linear storytelling that existed. All of a sudden, you start having all these U.S. troops stationed, bringing Disney, bringing, you know, Bugs Bunny, bringing Superman.
Yes, exactly.
And you start seeing an adoption in both directions of these concepts. So that's when what we consider the modern manga era to have been born. And it was almost an instantaneous sea change on both sides of the ocean. Because you had these U.S. soldiers coming back from Japan with manga, and then you also had manga artists starting to fold the idea of a westernized sensibility into what would be Japanese culture, and birthing what I think probably was, and you know, times were rough. I'm just going to say times were kind of rough.
Yeah, that's fair, I think, under the circumstances.
In the occupation years. But I think this is one of those things that we can point to say, you know what, we might all be okay one day.
Exactly.
This happened.
Buried in here.
Do what there?
There's hope buried in there. It's interwoven into the tapestry of this narrative.
Right. No, you are correct. So can we talk about Astro Boy for a second? Because I think that's really.
I think we have to, because in many ways, Astro Boy becomes the first breakaway manga, the first one to really get traction outside of Japan or outside of the region of the world or that hemisphere, because, well, Superman becomes ubiquitous worldwide. You know, every man, woman, and child in America, or in the world, rather, would become aware of Superman.
Right.
A lot of what was going on in manga, even though some of it was being carried back from occupied Japan, it never really there aren't any really icons,
right?
In the 40s and 50s,
correct.
Probably because they were buried under a mountain of iconic American comics.
Well, there were so few.
Yeah,
you know, it's not like it. You guys don't. I'm about to get on my old man soapbox again. You guys don't understand what it was like prior to even, let's say, 1995, right? Even prior to my graduation of high school, Cole's going to college, you know, we didn't have access to what we have now. You didn't go online and go to, you know, Amazon and order whatever you want. It was damned near, unless you had a specialty bookstore or a specialty, you know, or a hookup, some sort of mailing list.
And I think a lot of it also, I'm going to speculate here.
Yeah.
Based solely on the fact that, like, many years ago, I went nuts for imported Japanese Godzilla, Ultraman, Gamera.
Wives.
The hollow, blow-molded plastic figurines.
Yeah.
From Bandai, mostly. And to the point, I used to have a sizable collection, which actually...
I'm shocked.
Wound up, garnering me quite a bit of money when I did sell it. But, and I still own three or four pieces from that. But the thing about it is that I remember there was one guy, I talk about the hookups, I met this guy at a convention who was bringing in a lot of this stuff at a time when it was still pretty hard to find in Texas, but he was he would translate stuff for me, like tell me the names of the characters and stuff. If I bought things, I could send him a description or
and what whatnot. Is this? And he would tell you.
Yeah, and he was telling me like the history of Ultraman, that it started out as a show called Ultra Q, and all this other stuff. But he had grown up in Los Angeles. He said, "Oh yeah, you know, didn't you ever see Ultra Q or Ultraman or this and that, and the other, and, you know, all these shows?" I was like, "We got Speed Racer translated into English. And that was about it."
Right.
But apparently, like in LA and on the West Coast, there was a lot more vibrant Asian culture.
Yeah.
And a lot more, you know, people bothering to disseminate that. You know, that may play on the West Coast, but here in Texas, nobody was touching that stuff.
Yeah. Now imagine, you know, the Midwest.
Yes, exactly.
Like it just wasn't happening. Like
a great dusky turd between here and there.
But I mean, I've spoke often of my father and his nerdy sci-fi ways. He you know, he knew of all, you know, he spoke to me of Ultraman. It's like, tell me about the before times.
Yes.
He spoke to me of Ultraman. So I knew of Ultraman, of any of the Japanese TV shows I knew about, but you know, of Astro Boy, I knew of, and, but beyond that, I had no clue. So I think that we can really point at the American occupation of Japan, and then post-occupation, the relationship that was built between America and Japan, for better or worse, and we're not here to have a socio-political conversation.
Yeah.
Coupled with the, like you said, the swinging 60s and the beginning of things like of having an icon. You know, Astro Boy was the first manga icon that I think went worldwide.
Yeah.
And that's
there's just something about that plucky little robot.
And you know what's really funny is, so right? But that's what kind of set the tone for the look that we as Americans began to associate with the form. The over-exasperated emotional panels, the big eyes, those things are recognized as indicative of, at that point, of what we would consider Japanese manga, comic
book. And it almost becomes like a national style. There's considerable drift, but it almost, you know, as an outsider, as someone who and you know, apologies to absolutely everyone who's
figuring
a fan
it out
of manga
tonight, Cole. We're figuring it out.
But it seems like there are two or three distinct looks that occur in manga. They're like these specific flavors. One is the more cartoony style. One is this very harsh pen and ink kind of heavy accentuated shadows and an exaggeration, almost like noir. And then you've got the big eyes.
Yeah. Like
where that almost like treads between the two at times.
Yeah, for Berserk, Fist of the North Star. Some of these that I picked. You remember Fist of the North Star?
I remember Fist of the North Star.
Those are those real serious, you know, tend to be a lot more adult oriented.
Because I also remember the short-lived Heel of the South Star.
Sure, Heel of the South Star.
Heel of the South Star didn't catch on nearly as well as Fist of the North Star.
Well, here's the key, right? You got to keep both heels in the bag.
Oh, that's true.
Or the bread goes bad.
That's right. Plus you're poisoned.
South Star Bread Company.
That's right.
Don't ever forget South Star. We're going to die. Somebody's going to kill us over this issue of Hey Kids Comics. This is where the show ends, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a fun run. Glad we got 255 issues. So at this point, that's sort of what we look at when we say manga. And that's as far as we're going to slip, fall, dive, and slide through what would be the history of this. There are people that can do that a lot better than us. We're stepping back from that aspect of what we're talking about, and we're going to go to something we know a lot more about, which is the affluence, the effect of that culture being infused into American comics, because here's what's really interesting.
Well, also, I do want to point out, though, that you begin in the 70s is the first point where you really start to see a toehold.
Right.
And then certainly by the 80s, at a time when there is a prevalence of anime, where we're starting to go from Japanese cartoons to anime.
Right.
Because when I was a kid, you know, you go see that, I think I mentioned the King Kong or Speed Racer. Every now and again, you might see something else. There was a weird ass like Space Pinocchio thing.
I spent some time. Here's how far down the rabbit hole I went on the research for this show. I spent probably an hour on Yahoo Answers seeing if anybody could give me a good answer for this show. One thing I didn't see is some kind of Space Pinocchio thing.
I wish everyone could see some kind of Space Pinocchio.
Space Pinocchio is our Japanese is the Muggerville Sevens anime influenced character.
Yes, right. Yeah, Space Pinocchio was a big part of the Muggerville Seven in the early days. The golden age of the Muggerville 7. And for those of you watching at home, it is 1965. And this, like, what's creepy is this was the year I was born. 1965's Pinocchio in Outer Space.
Is it? It's called Pinocchio in Outer Space.
Yes, indeed.
Wow.
Right down to a rocket-powered sperm whale.
Really?
Which was incredibly creepy as a child. Yeah, check it out. Pinocchio in Outer Space.
Okay. Real thing. You weren't imagining it. It's an actual deal. All right. So I wanted to talk about how when we started seeing that influence kind of trickle into comics in the U.S. and what effect it had. Because I can tell you what I'm kind of used to, what I've seen, which was you had the golden age of comics in terms of, like, you know, literally the way they age comics, right? We're not talking about the golden age the way that Cole hates to use the term golden age. The actual golden age of comics, which was, you know, your Justice Society. Everybody was sort of standard people size, right? Like, nobody was LaFelded. Nobody got the LaFell gene yet, like, or the Joe Mad gene, or the Dale Cone gene. You know, everybody was sort of...
Or like the weird, lanky Ichabod Crane Tony Millionaire.
Yeah. No, but you're right. And then some point the 70s started, but still wasn't there. It still wasn't there. You started to see some more defined muscles as we started to see that on TV and in the movies with our stars. You know, everybody became a little more Burt Reynolds and Steve McQueen and a little less Cary Grant as time went on. But it wasn't until the late 70s, early 80s that I think we really saw somehow it finally caught up. And people started being highly influenced by anime in the West.
Oh, exactly. And I think that it was the anime that blazes the trail that you begin to see more and more manga, and you start to see the hardcore folks, like at a convention where we were wandered into a video viewing room and somebody was shushing people because they were talking over whatever the anime that became Star Blazers here, but it was in the original Japanese, and
yeah,
people were just talking because they weren't really sure what was going on, much less what was being said. And so I got very adamant, and it was this period where people were like trying to learn Japanese so they could read manga in its original unadulterated form, or learn to, at least speak or at least understand Japanese so they could watch anime in Japanese.
There's this weird line in the sand between, and I've experienced it a great many times, at least. I'm going to say in the past, I don't know if it's still indicative, but definitely in the past, there was this weird line in the sand between fans of comic books, let's call them American comic books, and fans of anime, where there was this odd, I don't know what term to use, but there was this odd idea that there was a kind of a friction there, where I would hear you again, we're for a long time, comic book fans who were supposed to be the most inclusive people in the world were awful, bad, bad people. And what we would see is this kind of punching down, you know, for trying to improve themselves and trying to learn Japanese and trying to understand something outside of American culture.
I think because it was such an alien concept at the time, and it almost at times it struck one as pretentious, because frankly some people who were some of the practitioners were pretentious. But at the same time, it was something unique, and people were stepping outside of themselves and trying to discover something new and different and embrace something more fully than just on average.
I think that's true. And I think that people didn't understand it. And like I said, like of a certain generation, I still don't understand it. I don't understand how I'm sorry. Maybe this makes me a bad person. I don't know. There's so much that it's so hard for me to begin to get my head around. But also, there's so many comic books that because I can get my head around it, it took me – so let's put anime in terms of the X-Men.
Okay.
Let's look at it from that perspective, right? And again, really what's happening here is us trying to figure this shit out. Like seriously, that's – we feel bad. And we're trying to make it right. So let's look at it in terms of X-Men. Somebody trying to get into comic books now and read X-Men. Excuse me. If I were to walk into a comic book store and say, show me your X-Men comics, please, I would probably have a nervous breakdown and run screaming and fleeing from the establishment, because it's virtually impossible to know where to begin.
Oh, absolutely. There's no good jumping on point, especially given the nature of that beast.
So, is there a good place to begin with this? I am positive there is. Somebody would tell me probably Astro Boy, you know, and then work their way through what I'm into and figure out something good for me. Probably Berserk, you know.
What's interesting about the genre is that it is so all-encompassing that the creations under the manga label are so diverse. You have everything from, like, romances and it's almost like if the comic industry was like the film industry.
Sure.
Because they're throwing so much out there to appeal to such a variety of readers that there's literally something for everybody out there in ways that you don't necessarily see in American comics, and that there are genres that manga tackle on a regular basis that have been out of the American comic vernacular for decades.
Go on.
Well, for example, outside of Arch Jughead's Double Digest and Betty and Veronica, you don't see a lot of, like, you know, young romance or things like that that used to be staples in the pre-comic era, or the pre-comic era, the pre-superhero era.
Yeah. No, you're not wrong. And I think that's part of what confuses me. Do you know the other part that really confuses me? And I have had three different people try to explain this to me. Three different fans of the medium try to explain this to me, and I still can't. And that is the manga sports genre.
Ah.
Baffles me. Absolutely baffles me.
Yeah, because in American comics, the closest you get to something like that is NFL Super Bro.
You get the X-Men occasionally playing basketball and not being allowed to use their powers, or the Avengers, West Coast Avengers annual softball game.
As you know very well from comic sports balls editions of this very show.
We need to talk about these sports because there's a manga that I tongue-in-cheek only to upset people that I know that it upsets called Reggie Tennis Queen. which is a tennis-based manga. There's also a manga, an insanely popular manga called Slam Dunk, that has been around, that is one of the highest-selling manga of all time, and it's a basketball-based manga story. And a culture, let me say this, a culture so far, we should all by now have bowed to the supremacy of the Japanese. And here's why I say that. Because a culture that can produce and sell 150 million comic books, I'm going to call them comic books, I know they're not, just stop yelling at me, based on basketball, and a culture so evolved that what they need is a comic book based on basketball versus what we need, which, by and large, 90% of what we get are comic books based on, you know, TNA and violence and the same retold stories 1,000 times, no original ideas. The X-Men are back. The original X-Men are back for the fifth time. Oh, look, Cyclops is getting to do all the same things Cyclops did before, but for a new generation.
Exactly.
Oh! I read a comic 2 days ago, Cole, where Cyclops met with his dad and went out with the Starjammers because that didn't
happen.
The
Starjammers are still around?
Yeah, that didn't happen 25 years ago, so let's just do it exactly. Again. But a society that is so far advanced that to sate their carnal and mortal desires, they need a comic book about literally a slice-of-life comic about a basketball team? We should all strive to that utopia. We should all reach for that as the bar. That's what I'm saying.
And I think that's what's so amazing about anime, about manga, is that you do have that kind of variety where you can tell these types of stories and, like you said, sell millions of copies. And when does that happen? How does that happen? How is that even a thing? But yet it is, because it's just such a culturally impactive
Oh, it yeah.
kind of a medium. And you know, there are things that, and then the industries feed each other in the way the toy industry used to feed Saturday morning cartoons. Manga, the lines begin to blur between manga and anime, where it becomes a which came first sort of arrangement. You know, like one of the few animes that I ever really got into was Lupin the Third.
Yes.
Because I found out by accident that that half-assed version of Dragon's Lair that was cobbled together from an anime was based on a series, Lupin the Third, and some feature films as well, mostly taken from the Castle of Cagliostro, and or Cagliostro rather. Cagliostro was the Rip McFarlane ripoff.
You're not wrong.
And the Mind of Mamal. And what was amazing is, you know, like, oh my God, I discovered this and I just fell for it. It was a bit of a challenge to find any of that. And when you did, it was such a treat. But the, all of them would say, you know, based on the Lupin the Third by Monkey Punch. So, in the same way as how do you have a basketball-themed comic that sells millions? How do you get to go out and have a popular manga that becomes an anime that becomes a tonnage of toys and stuff? I just recently acquired a little imported Lupin the Third car, the actual their little mini. The you know all this, and it's all by Monkey Punch. Which sounds more like something in this country you'd find on Urban Dictionary. Let that one sink in. No, I'm saying that. Do not let that one sink in.
Bad idea. But I will say this, right? I can sit here all day long and say that I don't understand manga, and it's past me, and I've tried to watch anime, and it just doesn't. I can't figure it out. But I have probably watched Cowboy Bebop, the series and the movie, literally 20 times. It is one of my favorite things in the world, and I will watch it over and over again. And that, so that tells me that I'm missing the point somewhere if I can do that, and then I can turn my nose up at something and say, I just don't get it. I'm not trying hard enough. This is on me. To not try hard enough.
I don't know that there is necessarily an imperative that one has to embrace everything, but at the same time, you know, it's very difficult sometimes to challenge yourself to branch off into something new and unfamiliar.
But I guess if this is us trying to come to parity with this situation, right? I feel a certain amount of guilt for not, right? Because I can sit here all day long and talk a big game about comic books, and I can, right? I feel like I have a certain pedigree to be able to do that, not just the 255 plus hours that we've recorded, but, you know, years and years of reading comics and trying to understand the paradigm in which we exist with them and how it reflects society and change and history and blah, 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 the whole show that we do. But I can also turn my nose up at 400 years of the thing that influenced and gave us, in a lot of respects, I think, the art form, the storytelling that I constantly say is the absolute best means of storytelling, is a shitty thing for me to do.
Yeah, perhaps so. And I think also it's important to recognize the influences, because we talked ages ago about the origins of the American comic and how the medium has been around for over a century. And it, you know, here we are at this late juncture, finally happening to explore that it didn't really, it isn't precisely an American idea. There was a bit of a slow moving zeitgeist there that I think that, you know, the American comic began in a very American way, but it was by no means completely original.
But that's the most American way ever, yeah. Right?
I don't know that it was necessarily inspired by, But it's kind of interesting that for centuries before, something akin to that had already been going on, and in many ways we were none the wiser.
Well, if American comics are Elvis Presley, I think you have to acknowledge that the storytelling that came from manga and before that was sort of the John Lee Hooker, B.B. King.
So true.
You know, we can sit all day and say this was, you know, it was more than I believe at the end of the day, it was more than informed by manga. You know, I think it was informed, but I think it was more than informed. And speaking of informed by manga, I think we need to, as we get long in the tooth here, I think this hour went by way too quick. I think I was nervous about admitting guilt.
Yeah, we were prepared to fall back on a lot of things that were a little more familiar, like the way that the manga influenced the decidedly American comic
book. Yeah, I think we needed to at least spend, you know, a little bit of time there in that world. You know, because it did. Because as, like we were saying, as we approached into the 80s and kind of moved into the late 70s, early 80s, we started seeing a real heavy influence. And we've already touched on kind of the progenitor, the proto for this, the last two issues, I think. But I think that now we really have to say, put a big Hey Kids comic stamp on Frank Miller as the guy that really kind of decided that the manga influenced style and US American based comics were the peanut butter and jelly that needed to be there for the next 30 years. As we get into guys like Jim Lee, who are so heavily influenced by that art style, Joe Madureira, Dale Cohen. I would even go as far as to say Perez. If you look at some of his work, definitely was a little influenced by, you know, as those two things became folded together, as there was a, you know, an emulsion forming, that I think Perez even got into it a little bit if you started looking at his work.
And I think one of the things that I guess perhaps was a detractor for me was the American, the manganizing of American comics.
The diaspora. Yeah.
Yeah, where a lot of it, because of the nature of published material. For example, you know, Ronin, Frank Miller's Ronin.
Oh, my God.
1983, heavily influenced by the rising tide of manga. But it doesn't look like manga. It looks like Frank Miller's budding half-ass style.
So can I ask, while we're on the topic of Frank Miller, so you know that story we all have about Freddie Mercury?
Oh, yes.
Where we all ask our, you know, like Freddie Mercury, Queen was hugely popular, Freddie Mercury, and somebody eventually was like, not that, you know, it was like, you know, Freddie Mercury is, he's gay. Yeah. And everybody was like, no. How did I not see, you know, how did I not realize?
You really want to freak people out. In this day and age, you say, well, you know, Freddie Mercury was gay. And they're like, yeah.
Well, no, of course.
You know, Freddie Mercury was Middle Eastern. Then they'll freak out.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. You're absolutely right. But I remember as a kid,
it's like, guess what? So was Casey Kasem.
So was Scooby-Doo. No, I guess Shaggy. Oh. Yeah, and Robin. But my mind was blown when somebody told me that. Not in a negative way, but like, okay, yeah, I get it. I think, why did it take us so long? Why did we hang the Princess Leia Medal of Valor around Frank Miller's neck for so many years before we finally were like, wait, he's been insane for like 30 years.
Yeah, well, the insanity was always there, but it was like kind of like Chewbacca. It just didn't get a medal.
It just didn't get recognized because he was avant-garde. He was cutting edge.
Yeah.
Until I think that has to sink in long enough for you to really look at it and say, yeah, maybe he was, but also he didn't like drawing hair and loved drawing ninjas because it was easier than drawing anything else.
Exactly. You can just turn the ninjas over to the inker.
By the way, that should be on a t-shirt somewhere. just turn the ninjas over to the Inker. Yeah, but no, you're not wrong. You know, Ronan was, and we're going to get into Ronan more in the last issue of this story arc. But Ronan is what a lot of people point to as the first, kind of the real opening salvo, the shot heard it around the U.S. comics industry that we should all be paying attention to Japan for a lot of the influence that we were going to be seeing going forward.
Yeah.
But it does deal with a Neo Tokyo, a future based, or I guess a Neo New York, a future based New York, that, was heavily influenced by Tokyo, that I think we'll probably get into in the last issue a little more when it comes to the storyline.
Yes.
But I think what's really interesting about Ronin was, it was supposed to be part of the Marvel graphic novel series with everybody's favorite, The Death of Captain Marvel, and I'm trying to think of God Loves, Man Kills. But it took him too long to give Crazy Miller the thumbs up to do it.
Spider-Man and Hooky. Almost nobody remembers that. Who was the
what?
Al Williamson, or no? Who was the artist on that? Yeah, look it up. It was one of the last of the graphic novels ever published by Marvel.
Spider-Man and Hooky?
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's
either Hooky or Hooky. We were never really entirely sure.
We were never given the heads up. But DC swept in and stole him for this comic that was based heavily on Lone Wolf and Cub, by the way. And ran it under the same kind of, I guess it wasn't an imprint, but let's call it an imprint.
Yeah.
That they were running everybody's Hey Kids Comics favorite Camelot 3000 under, which means it got prestige formatting, no advertising, that prestige push. But yeah, this was one
Ernie
of those things.
Ernie Wrightson was the artist on that, by the way.
On what?
Spider-Man Hooky.
Who was the artist?
Ernie Wrightson.
Bernie fucking Wrightson?
Yes.
Jesus Christ. Spider-Man Hooky. All right. We might have to do something on Spider-Man Hooky. At some point, we might have to do another recommended reading, Cole. Remember Spider-Man Hooky, because... I want that to go somewhere into the arc there, the conversation. So yeah, we're not going to get into the plot. We'll get into the plot later, but yeah. It's important to note that this was this opening salvo that led to, like I said, led to Jim Lee, led to Image. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Led to,
I think one of the things that, you know, I was trying to get at earlier and sort of lost track of was the fact that you start to see such influence of manga that then you get a lot of people who are just sort of copyists, as it were,
yeah.
Where they're just trying to adopt a manga style because that's the hip thing to do. And you also see a lot of published stuff where it's in manga-esque style that's American produced. As kind of a cash grab, like we're trying to lure in the manga kids, and to me that just I always felt uncomfortable about that. I mean, it seemed like so pretentious and thinly veiled.
Well, look no further. Since we're getting ready to wrap up the show, what I think is the worst offender for that cash grab, and something that I have issues of this somewhere here that I never have read. And that is the Marvel manga-verse.
Oh, yes, exactly. I don't know why that one just didn't...
What's unfortunate about the Marvel manga-verse was that it was... Some of the art was done by Ben Dunn. And Ben Dunn was the artist that worked on and created, I believe, if I'm not crazy, which I think I'm not, Ninja High School, which was one of the
yes,
most...
Indeed.
highly...
Antarctic Press in San Antonio, Texas, who, by the way, Ben Dunn just very recently announced establishing of Antarctic Press Dallas.
Really?
Yes, he will be... I think he's spent so much time in Dallas working and getting to know a lot of very talented people here. He is actually beginning to open up a satellite studio to cull this talent here.
A North? Yeah.
Yeah.
But the problem I have with this is, just like any other Ultimates universe or any other Heroes Reborn universe, or even now the Marvel Now relaunching with this legacy, go-nowhere legacy thing that they did, this was basically the most unoriginal idea that they tried to fold into originality, which was essentially just a manga cash grab. That's all it was.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they see this as the thing. It's... you know, bookstores are starting to go from a manga shelf to a manga section.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a cash grab in the way that Marvel Zombies was a cash grab.
Yeah. Yes.
It's just trite and pointless and about nothing more than turning a quick buck.
It's insulting. And it's
I think that you have articulated what I was failing to do. That yes, it is insulting. It wasn't uncomfortable. It was an insult.
It was an insult to manga fans. It was an insult to comic book fans. It was an insult to fans of Marvel.
Yes.
Like, why? Who is this for? If this is for the comic book fan to get them into manga, you don't need it. Because yeah. We are surrounded by it. There's so we will find something if we are interested and read it, I promise you. If it's for the manga fan to get into comic books, guess what? The other side of that is true. We, as a manga fan, you have nth number of comics that you could pick up and read that would be perfectly great and that you could get into. Who is this for? That's my question.
Yeah.
Who are you trying to trick with this shit?
Well, it was who it was for was Marvel.
Yeah. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. And I think that the part that really, really bothers me about this, well, you know, one of those things that DC has always done better than Marvel is to honor a genre or honor another lane of a similar way to tell a story in such a way as not to insult anyone. Now, that's not always true. That's not always true. But they've done a pretty good job. And there is a... DC has done their own... I know. Don't send me the email saying Stanley's just imagined. Shut up. I get it. They aren't all winners.
Oh, wow.
But do you remember the Bat manga... that came out.
That one may have escaped my knowledge up to this point.
It's great. So if you want, if you're an American comic book fan that is looking for some way to kind of dip their toes in just to see, Bat manga was a fantastic book. You can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it at your local comic shop. The Secret History of Batman in Japan is what it's Bat manga, but it goes in and it talks all about Batman's influence in Japan and how long it's been there and what's going on and guess what started it? I mean, I think you can pretty much point at what happened in 66, 67.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, another thing that brings that to bear is I've seen manga of American comics that originated in Japan, where manga ought to be originating.
Spider-Man.
And, you know, that's... We didn't need a manga-verse.
No.
All you needed to do is either arrange or... you know, publish good manga from Japan.
Right.
That is licensed Marvel stuff.
Buy it. Spend the money on it.
Yeah, don't just try to hire a bunch of people who do manga-style stuff. And I do want to point out that a glaring omission from our last episode was Ninja High School. Duh. Right. You know?
I said stuff just kept coming back up after we got done.
Man.
We it was Icarus. We flew too close to the sun on a lot of things last issue that we should have talked about and didn't. But all that being said, Cole, we need to wrap this up.
Yeah, we are probably running a little long here.
I don't know. We'll right up against an hour, and I don't know how we got there. But I think we did a pretty good job. I don't know, but I don't think we failed too badly at this tonight.
Not at all. I think we managed to flounder through without, you know, flopping around too much, and to bring some outsiders' insight.
Right. Go pick
which
up
is my way of just like justifying how patently unaware we are of this.
Right. Right. So. Listen, Cole, where can people email us if they have any resources for us or want to tell us where we should start our journey here?
Or tell us what we can do with our
ideas,
our complete lack of knowledge. And you can write to us at heykidscomics@gmail.com. You can, of course, you're finding us here on the Jedi Cole Universe, jedicole.com. Big shout out to – I've been over helping the folks at Holocron Toys who are going to be opening – on Saturday, the 13th of January, their new Star Wars shop in Fort Worth, Texas. It's been a lot of fun. And one of the folks there mentioned, I just started listening to Hey Kids Comics last night. So if you happen to catch this latest episode and managed to struggle through to this point.
We're sorry for this one.
Yeah, thank you for sticking with it. We really appreciate any new listeners. And so, you know, watch for us on, I'm going to be trying to put the episodes of Isle of Toys up on the YouTube channel here pretty soon. So
there you go.
We'll have that's that exciting. To look forward to, and I might actually start tweeting again at some point.
Twitter it up.
Twitter has become sort of it's one of those things. It just kind of lost a lot of its magic. I don't know why these days, but...
Well, here's the thing, right? I'm still hitting the tweets pretty hard for Hey Kids Comics. So, we're still getting the posts out there for everybody. People are still knowing what's going on. Feel free to jump on and interact on there. We would love to hear from you and talk to you. Also on those Instagrams, we're on that as well. Facebook's still active, still working. Not as active as maybe Twitter or Instagram, but it's still there. So we're still alive out there. We're getting ramped back up post holidays. We jumped into the story arc pretty hard, and this was a daunting task. So what else you got going on? What else you want to plug?
Well, in the meantime, the first and third Sundays of every month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Central Time, streaming live out of downtown Dallas, Texas, is the Rantcor Pit Live.
Yeah, baby.
And an hour before that, on the first Sundays of the month, Figments with my co-host Eddie Medina and his wife Colleen Medina, the cryptid couple, will take you through all kinds of bizarre big feats and conspiracies and urban legends and all kinds of cool stuff, UFOs. It's like In Search Of without as much
Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, without so much Leonard Nimoy. And on the third Sundays of every month, my new show, Isle of Toys. This next show will be the third Sunday of whatever month this is, January, of course. My special guest, Brett Weiss, who has written extensively on console gaming and home video gaming systems, will be joining me for Straight Outta Console.
That's awesome.
Which is the sixth episode. This show is now half a year old.
That's amazing.
And so be sure and join me for Isle of Toys, Isle 6, Straight Outta Console.
That's
so all
awesome.
On DallasOnAir.com.
That is great. So what are we talking about next week? Let's move into this. What are we talking about next week?
Well, next week I am going to need a refresher here because
talking about modern day Japan in comics next week.
I think you may be right.
I believe that's what we're talking about because then the last issue of the arc was about future.
Yeah.
So I believe that's accurate. So I think next week we're going to be able to
we're going to be talking about something that has something to do with comics and Japan and the influence of Japanese comics and you know, as you may have guessed from the title of this.
Yeah.
This
arc. So I just wanted, as we get out of here, I just wanted to thank everybody for listening to this week's issue of Two Middle-Aged White Guys Trying to Figure It Out. Appreciate that. And we are going to go now and hang our heads in shame and try to get a little more educated on manga. But thank you guys for bearing with us. We wouldn't do it without you guys. So say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody. And also, if you happen to be listening to the show and you were in Arlington, Texas about 10 years ago and your parents had a shop and you loaned me your Berserks, I'd love to get them back to you.
That's right. Get back to Cole on that.
You'll know who you are. This is like a Craigslist misconnections or something.
This is the least viewed Craigslist misconnection.
Oh God, yes. I mean, it's like zero
the most
views.
Specific misconnection ever. All right, everybody, join us next week for more Higgins Comics. Good night. Say good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.